Society on American Culture is meeting at Haverford in April this year, it happens. Mr. Ashmead plans, as part of their acquaintance with the distinctive American culture, to drive them round to three of the local old colonial meeting houses. If you know this territory at all, you will know what I mean. Old-fashioned stone buildings, many of them quite large, with a characteristic architecture, two doors in front usually, and with a curious device in the middle of the old one by which they were divided into two halves. That was because their business meetings, the men and women met separately. And by having a sliding partition, or rather a falling partition, on pulleys, they could turn this meeting house into two parts. But I just mentioned the meeting houses as not a primitive feature, yes?
Didn't they also meet separately, the women and the men, in the regular meeting for worship?
I think they did in the beginning. I should say that had been abandoned in my own lifetime, at least in America.
Well,
I'm not sure why.
I've been to one where they're still... I have been to a meeting.
You've been to such a meeting, yes.
The partition was raised, but...
Yes. The house is in two parts, there's usually a middle aisle, and there are benches here, and there are benches there, and down here there's a machinery by which they can let a wooden partition down. Sometimes where it comes up from the floor and down and meets in the middle. And there are, at the front of the meeting, as in the Haverford meeting house, they're facing benches, of course, too. Haverford's that way, but I don't know that ever had a partition. Of course, another way of arranging for men and women to have separate rooms is to have an extra room, a small extra room. And either the men or the women can adjourn to that. The division is open during the meeting for worship. And partly for the convenience of being where they want to be afterwards, and partly through habit, the men and women sit on opposite sides, or did. In the beginning, in a place like London, I think the men and women were kept this way so that the men could be on the alert for disturbance, kind of to protect the women. I don't have to plead by violence, but at any rate, they could close in on the women, keep the intruders away. These meeting houses, I say, are noted in by American architects because of their simplicity and beauty and their functional utility. Sometimes nowadays they have a fireplace in the meeting house. And as a matter of fact, they had stoves and chimneys, not steeples of course, stones and chimneys, long before churches had any heating apparatus. I don't know why the churches were so stoical in England, but it was commented upon, especially in New England, that the Quakers had fires, that is, stoves, in their meeting houses. Well, so much for the externals. I'm sure part of the reason for the Quaker manner of worship was reaction against everything that was formal, premeditated, uninspired, or in danger of being uninspired. Of course, it was a reaction against the Catholic, as they were in other respects. They were extremely anti-Catholic. And you might say that the absence of form and forms became itself a form. You'll be interested to know that in the very early times, some Quakers thought that the Quaker meeting was too formal, even so. They objected to having a fixed hour or place to meet. Isn't that consistent with their theory? If it's purely spontaneous, You don't need to say we meet at 11 o'clock on Sundays in a somebody's residence or even in a formal meeting house. They objected to shaking hands at the close of meeting, which is the signal by which two people in the front of the meeting usually give the sign that the meeting may now adjourn. And then there was the Quaker habit by which the men took off their hats in time of prayer. That's a form, isn't it? And there were a group of early friends that were so consistent, if you like, so ultra-consistent, that they objected to these things. This group did not prevail. And this much formality has continued, namely, an hour set, a place set. The men don't wear their hats all the time anyhow now, so that that particular thing isn't conspicuous. In the 17th century, men wore their hats all the time, indoors and out. And nowadays, it's very hard to find a man that's got a hat, so to speak, to express his Quakerism with, by not wearing. this shows that the extreme to which some people went. The theory behind the meeting is simple, namely that this is to worship God. The word meeting, I think, means quite as much meeting with God as it does meeting with your fellow Quakers. And that he can deal with men directly. And if he has a message for each one, he can communicate with that one. If he has a message that's meant for the group, he can communicate through one of the worshipers with the group as a whole. But you're not to take part, you're not to speak in the meeting until you have God's signal, so to speak. Now, this makes speaking and meeting a very delicate and sensitive problem, particularly for ultra-sensitive people. And during a period of their history, the Quakers became morbid, I think I might say, upon this question of whether or not God wanted them to speak in meeting. They hoped he would, but they're very much afraid that if they did, it would be their own initiative. They use phrases like running before your guide, or speaking in the creature, that is purely the creature, not the creator. And they were afraid of that. On the other hand, they felt that right speaking was really inspired. But what do you do with your reason, with your rationality in this kind of thing? That raises a difficult problem. And as you know, a person can go to a meeting and say, well, I got a good idea. This seems to me appropriate for this occasion. Here goes. I'll let them have it. That sort of thing. Well, that's a pretty cold-blooded way to express God's will, unless you think that God can speak through the human reason of an individual, and you might well think so. There have been times when speaking was regarded with so much awe, so delicate a matter, that nobody spoke at all. And I may add, there have been times when speaking was so easy and so informal that people popped up if they had an idea in their head and let it be heard, and you get these two extremes. Well, if I may say so, the speaking is a feature in itself of a delicate psychological character. But the theory is the same, that either in the silence or in the spoken word, God can communicate with the group, and one person can be given a message, and it sometimes seems to work that way. The speaking ought to grow out of the silence. And sometimes, with the intervals in between, you'll get the sense that the speaking is congenial to what has been said before. Now, it's all uncommon in a really devoted friends meeting for somebody to get up and say, what our friend has just spoken of had already been very much in my mind, or at least something similar to it. I don't think you need to look for anything more, but the normal psychology of a congenial group, sensitive to the situation. And in the best meetings, that is, shall I say, an alternative explanation to the supernatural explanation. There's a great deal that the ancients used to call supernatural that modern psychology calls psychological. And in various situations, astonishing coincidences occur, which an earlier generation would call supernatural. One of the most interesting sets of stories are the cases where a minister from a distance turns up as a stranger in a meeting and sits down, and they talk, sit there in silence for a while, and he gets up and says something which a member of the meeting thinks is addressed directly to him. He says, well, he often said, somebody must have told that man about me. But he hasn't. He's come as a stranger. And this is called speaking to states. And the coincidence, shall I use that word? The coincidence has been impressive to the spectator or to the person involved. Obviously, this is a very difficult type of worship. It's a great deal easier to worship if you have what I call audio-visual aids, or which a Quaker would call audio-visual hindrances. A Quaker who goes into a church where we're always jumping up or sitting down or having a hymn or a prayer or a sermon or a collection or something, when's he going to worship? In his familiar way, he'd have trouble. If he has the advantage of attending a communion service, there may be as much as 2 or 3 minutes of silence. And they can be for him, as they are for the others, a very profound experience. Though I think for the Quaker it has nothing to do with the bread and the wine, but merely with the unaccustomed silence that takes place in this meeting.